Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Rashana Johnson, whose new book is Sweet Home Feliciana, Family, Slavery, and the Hauntings of History.
Rashana Johnson is Associate Professor of History at the University of Chicago. She's the author of the prize-winning book, Slavery's Metropolis, Unfree Labor in New Orleans During the Age of Revolutions, which won the 2016 Williams Prize for the Best Book in Louisiana History. In her new book, she turns an eye on her own family's history. It's called Sweet Home Feliciana, Family, Slavery, and the Hauntings of History. Rashana Johnson, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Now, I know you grew up in New Orleans, so I have to ask where you went to high school.
Ben Franklin.
All right. Well done. And then you went on to Howard and then to NYU for your PhD. How did you become interested in labor as your research interest?
It was almost accidental. I think I started with an even more basic question of where were people of African descent in these places and what were they doing, kind of broadly defined. And for obvious reasons, it ended up being about labor because that's so much of what the enslaved experience was. But I think that's how I came to the question of labor, in part because it was one of, though not obviously all of, the things that many of the people I was interested in spent a whole lot of time doing. So I think that's the one part of it. And then the other part is, you know, I'm interested in enslaved people's lives and freed people's lives, but I'm also interested in the ways that their labor worked to advance larger projects, you know, the emergence of cities, of economies, of governments. And so I think that was another way of thinking about the role of people of African descent in shaping the world around us.
When you were growing up, I'm curious, how did you see African-American life writ large in the city around you?
You know,
so many people say they grow up and they realize that the entire city is a monument to slavery.
Yeah. I mean, I think it started with the wonderful parts. You know, there's so much rich African diasporic culture in New Orleans. And so I think it started with just being curious about how all of this came to be. I think going away and realizing that, oh, not everyone does this.
Yeah.
Unique to New Orleans. made me more intrigued. And, you know, I would also say that this is, you know, very specific, but my late mother had this kind of fascination with Black history and would point to various buildings or point to things that were former slave quarters or, you know, houses like that. And she'd say, look back there, like, look at that. And, you know, I think that was admittedly, you know, a sort of idiosyncratic introduction to the city's landscape. But I think those sorts of things stuck with me as well. And so I think that is another part of what has animated a lot of my scholarly interests, trying to think about the both and, right? How do you think about this rich culture and thinking about New Orleans as the center of the domestic slave trade? And so kind of reconciling those two things, one of them super celebratory and fun and sustaining, and the other, you know, less so, and kind of thinking about those two things, those two dynamics in relation to one another rather than the either or.
So what's the origin story of Sweet Home Feliciana? What was the spark that headed you down that road?
Well, I grew up with my grandmother. I spent a lot of time with her. And, you know, I had the occasional trip to the area she grew up, you know, her hometown, but I didn't spend a whole lot of time there. And when I was in undergrad, we had to do a project of interviewing our oldest relative. Uh-huh. So I interviewed my grandmother. And I think I was a sophomore in college. And I set it aside. I thought, you know, I'd come back to it and write an article later or something. And when I was in graduate school, I had a classmate and others who were deeply interested in family history. And I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe I can do an article or something. And so after the first book, I came back to it. And then I realized there was just so much more about that region that I just didn't know and didn't understand. And it just kept expanding from there.
I don't know if it's lack of awareness on my part, but and probably it is, but I don't feel like I've seen as much scholarship on those parishes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
I think that's fair. I mean, I think recently in kind of histories of capitalism, there were big debates about kind of the history of cotton and cotton plantations and the history of, you know, the emergence of industrial capitalism and so on. And so in that sense, I think those regions became important, but you didn't necessarily get the kind of everyday texture of life, you know, in those regions. That's not sort of their central, those scholars' central concerns necessarily. And so there is a way that their economic importance, I think people understand and appreciate that. But in terms of everyday life and African diasporic history, Black history, I think, and I'm, you know, part of this with my first book, I think there's so much of an emphasis on New Orleans for obvious reasons, right?
Sure.
It's such an interesting city that we sometimes don't pay enough attention to other parts of Louisiana. And as anyone from Louisiana or lives in Louisiana, you know, could tell you, I mean, it's a lot of different countries in one state, right?
Yeah.
Like there's just lots of different histories, lots of different cultures, and that's what makes it so interesting. And so I think that is part of what I wanted to take up. What does it mean to think about the history of Louisiana and the South, not from the position of the kind of Atlantic port city of New Orleans, which was my interest in the first book, but mm-hmm. instead from this other area, you know, this heart of the rural South, but also a crossroads next to the Mississippi and thanks to railroads and all sorts of other infrastructure. You know, I'm trying to make the case that this area was actually much more central than I think many subsequent scholars have been able to appreciate.
Well, as you describe them, they are like cauldrons of activity and energy. I mean, there are changes in the ruling powers, a diverse population fed by immigrants and slave markets, and a changing economy. There's just so much going on there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's what I found fascinating. I mean, we're used to thinking about, you know, global assemblages in urban areas, but we don't necessarily think enough, I think, about immigration to the South, period, but also immigration to the rural South, and to think about all the different geographies and cultures and languages that would have converged, not necessarily equally, right? I'm not telling a very romantic story here. It's still about kind of slavery and post-emancipation period and so on. But to really think about just how complicated this thing is that we call the rural South that sometimes gets flattened into, you know, something that's not as complex or fascinating as I think it actually is.
And you focus particularly on your grandmother's birthplace. So talk a little bit about that.
You know, I grew up hearing stories about this area. And I think as I got older, you know, the stories got to be a little bit more intense, I would say. But I'm a historian, and so on some level, I just kind of wanted to think about what I could know about this place by combining what I'd heard from my grandmother with the kinds of methodological tools I have as a, you know, as a trained historian. And, you know, in our field, we've been having a lot of debates about, you know, exactly how do you study the histories of people who weren't able to leave records? How do you think about, you know, ways of understanding these things? And that's part of the challenge I wanted to take seriously. How do I, you know, make sure I'm transparent about the ways that I have personal connections to this place and draw on them to share with the readers, while also combining that with lots and lots of documents in hopes of getting a prismatic view of this place and not making it only about my grandmother's perspectives or my memories or my associations or only about kind of archival methods, but to think about how to bring all these different things, documents, stories, my cousin's Mardi Gras Indian suit, all these things into kind of the same work to think about what that kind of juxtaposition can tell us, you know, relying on any one method alone could not.
And a lot of your book takes place in Clinton, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about Clinton and what sort of place it is.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, talking about complexity, you know, there are pretty meaningful distinctions between West Feliciana and East Feliciana.
Right.
And I think one of the things I found interesting is that, you know, West Feliciana is obviously very important. It's a hub of tourism, right? There are bus tours, and for good reason, right? It has a whole lot of the kind of southern quaint architecture and sort of small town feel. And so for obvious reasons, that area gets a lot of attention. Whereas, you know, East Feliciana, you know, less so. And I think I was fascinated by just how old that distinction is and just how salient it remains. And yeah, so I do spend a lot of time thinking about Clinton in part because it was, you know, the sort of hub of this area, like sort of to the extent that we can think about a kind of urban space, right? This did represent a pretty meaningful town with its own kind of marketing culture and its own governmental structures. And so that's why I wanted to zoom in there. And obviously there's the courthouse, which has meaning. And so, yeah, I thought it was just very important to reshape the way we think about these spaces, that if today we don't necessarily have, you know, the buses going up to Clinton specifically, that we can appreciate that in the 19th century, right, these sites were extraordinarily important and they remain important, right? There are all sorts of interesting things going on even in the present. And so, yeah, I think this is all consistent with my desire not to minimize the importance of a place like New Orleans or even Baton Rouge, but to think about the ways people lived and died in all of these spaces in the surrounding areas that were actually quite central to the emergence of these urban areas that we know, that many of us know, are, you know, are more familiar with and also are very important places in their own right.
Well, I'll just tell you this. A friend of mine got a speeding ticket in Clinton once. And when you get a speeding ticket in Clinton, you have to go back.
Oh.
You know, and so I said, oh, I'll go with you. So, you know, it'll be fun. We'll ride up to Clinton. You'll get off. It'll be great. And so we go and we sit there. The courthouse is full of people. It goes on all morning, speeding tickets and small, you know, kind of claim stuff. And then it gets to be lunchtime. And the judge calls my friend's name and says, now, I just want to say, usually when someone comes up to be, you know, have their tickets heard, and if we don't get to them before lunch, we make them wait in the jail during lunch. But I see that you've brought a friend with you, and because you brought your friend, we'll let you two go out to lunch together.
Oh my gosh. Well, now I know not to speed.
Never speed in Clinton, Louisiana. So how much time did you spend there when you were growing up? You talk about those roads with great familiarity.
Not a lot, actually. I mean, I can remember a couple of trips when I was a child, but not many. The handful of memories I have, I recount in the book, but I don't have many childhood memories of going there. And, you know, my parents' generation, you know, my mother, my aunts, they have memories of going, but I, as a kind of grandchild, I didn't spend a whole lot of time there. So in many ways, this book was a way of learning about this place that obviously has deep significance and meaning for me, but that, you know, but a place where I didn't necessarily have that kind of immediate personal experience in the way that, you know, some of my older relatives would have had.
Now, and you, like most historians, are in love with archives. So, and I'm in love with archives too, but I'm not trained to use them. I just love to wander around in them. So what was most useful to you? What were some of the surprises you found in archives?
Well, you know, it's actually interesting. In my field, people have been really critical of archival methods, you know, for the reasons I was just discussing. So in some ways, it is kind of interesting that I have leaned in on the archival methods here in this way, given some of those critiques and critiques that I take seriously and I think are actually really important. But yeah, I used a lot of archival records. I think some of the most, this is such a granular set of records, but the police jury records.
That was fascinating.
Because they're just so chock full of things, you know, just the minutiae, you know, day in, day out life. It's, you know, a lot of it kind of very formulaic, you know, allocate money for this, allocate money for that, build this, you know, pay this person that, you know, the day in, day out, workaday, you know, records of running a town. But then you'd get these, you know, really interesting vignettes and interesting stories that, you know, I would not have been able to access otherwise. And so, you know, I focus on Black history, but I really wanted to write about everyone who was there. And so there are these ways that, you know, interesting things about poor white people in the area come forward. You know, who's a pauper? Who needs public assistance? Why? Who's deserving? Who's not deserving? What kinds of, you know, funds for education are going to be allocated for people who can't afford funding? You know, those are the sorts of day in, day out granular records that, you know, any one record on its own can't necessarily tell you everything. But when you read kind of the rhythm of it, you do get a sense of like what's coming across the local elected officials' desks, you know, so to speak, what their priorities are, how they're shaping things, and also how people are pushing back against them. You know, I think a lot about resistance. I think about, you know, political conflict from all different sides. And, you know, I think those records can capture some of that as well. So, yeah, I think that's the first one that comes to mind only because I spent so much time with them and they're so granular that I was able to get to a lot of people's stories, including elite people, enslaved people, poor white people, immigrants. And I think that's what makes those records particularly fascinating.
If you're just joining us, Susan Larson is interviewing Rashada Johnson about her new book, Sweet Home Feliciana: Family, Slavery, and the Hauntings of History. Please be advised that this next section contains mentions of sexual violence.
One of the saddest moments in this book is when we learn that your great-grandmother was the result of a rape. And talk about writing that. That must have been very difficult for you and hard for your family, I imagine.
I mean, it is a very difficult subject. And I think it's difficult in part because it's not singular. You know, I think part of what I was trying to think about was, you know, we have lots of scholarship, and rightly so, on things like lynchings and other sorts of, you know, really violent acts in the South. And for good reason, right? We need to pay attention to those. But, you know, many scholars of gender and sexuality point out that, you know, this kind of sexual violence was actually endemic in the context of slavery and the post-emancipation period as well, and that these are things people knew about and talked about, and that these were, you know, things people had to kind of make sense of in their own ways. I think it was a difficult thing to think about. It's really, in hindsight, I think about the fact that my grandmother did not, in fact, share that with me until I was a young adult, I'm assuming, you know, for obvious reasons.
Sure.
You know, in hindsight, now that I'm older, I can think about, you know, why she wouldn't have said something like that sooner. But it's interesting that by the time she shared this with me, it was very clear that I was a historian and that I, you know, I was already in graduate school and so on. So I have, knowing, you know, how well she knew me, I knew that she knew that this was going to be on the record in some way, you know. And so in some ways, I think that, you know, while I don't linger, like I don't want to, you know, spend a whole lot of time on that, you know, I try to handle it with delicacy in the book for any number of reasons, out of sensitivity for readers and for myself. I do think it's important to note this because this wasn't singular, right? This is, you know, one family story, but there are versions of this, you know, everywhere. And so I think it's important to name those sorts of things, you know, because these are parts of, you know, it's a difficult part of the history, but it is a part of the history. And, you know, we have to, as best we can, tell the truth about these sorts of things if we're going to, you know, deal with them and figure out how to keep moving forward.
Now, you begin this book on such a note of joyful transformation, the story of your cousin Veronica's Mardi Gras Indian suit, which pays tribute to the women of your family. And it's just filled with joy, but it's also filled with the weight of history as well. And I wonder if you'd read the passage where she describes what it's like to put on that suit.
Of course. And I felt so good because that suit was the heaviest suit I ever made. Not in weight. Every suit that I make is heavy. They'll tell you all my suits is heavy. But that was the heaviest suit I ever worn in the 7 years I wore a suit. because it felt like I had every woman warrior in my life that was on me. My grandpa, he was a warrior, but I'm talking about the women. Every woman that was in my life that was on that suit, and she was one of the last ones that was on that suit. I didn't beat her. I didn't broach her. I didn't stone her out, but she was clenched on each side, on my left and my right. And that felt wondrousful to me because she was that last stepping stone of the suit that came to completion to me. So I felt like good. So yeah, that purple suit meant a whole lot to me, even though I was trying to back out of it, but she wasn't letting me. It was like, no, Godchild, no, you're going to put me out on this street today. And I did. And when I came out that door with her and all the other women's with me, I felt like I was bigger than the world. When I tell you, I felt that suit was one of the heaviest suits. I mean, not because of the work that was on the suit, but I felt like that was one of the heaviest suits. But I promise you, it was one of the lightest suits I ever made. Man, I felt good. I really did.
That is such a such a wonderful moment.
Oh, thank you.
We've been talking with Roshana Johnson, whose new book is Sweet Home Feliciana, Family, Slavery, and the Hauntings of History. Roshana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. Poets Liz Burke, Peter Cooley, Rodney Jones, Julie Kane, and Biljana Obradovic read at the Poetry Buffet Saturday, April 4th at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. In celebration of National Poetry Month, the New Orleans Pelicans are partnering with One Book Wood New Orleans for Pelicans and Poetry. Local poets Stacey Balkan, Kelly Jarvis DeBerry, Sky Jackson, Sean Monroe, and Christopher Romaguero will appear for a reading and happy hour before tip-off against the Utah Jazz, Tuesday, April 7th. Use the special ticket link and a portion of the proceeds benefits One Book. Juliet Cross discusses and signs Blood Singer, the second book in the Fire That Binds series, Wednesday, April 8th at 6 p.m. at the Garden District Bookshop. Damaris Smith discusses and signs Turf Wars, the fight for the soul of America's game, Thursday, April 9th at 6 p.m. at Baldwin Company. This is a ticketed event. Rap artist 2 Chainz discusses and signs The Voice in My Head is God, Friday, April 10th at 6 at Baldwin Company. This is a ticketed event. The Friends of the Jefferson Parish Library hold their big book sale Friday through Sunday, April 17th through 19th, 2026 at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Friday and Saturday, April 17th and 18th from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. and Sunday, April 19th from noon to 5 p.m. Free admission and free parking. This is one of the largest book sales in the New Orleans area with over 65,000 items for sale, including gently used adult and children's books, puzzles, DVDs, CDs, and records. Cash and credit and debit cards are accepted, but no checks. The Books Along the Tesh Literary Festival will celebrate its 10th anniversary in New Iberia in April 2026. Each year brings readers, writers, and lovers of Louisiana culture together. This milestone year features Rick Bragg, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and storyteller, along with a dynamic schedule of events that showcases the cultural significance and beauty of Southern storytelling. Scott and Jane Wolfe of Melba's Po' Boys fame will kick off the festival Friday, April 10th at noon with their story of resilience, hard work, entrepreneurship, and love for each other. Check out the offerings on subjects as varied as Creole trail riders to romanticy, from the history of swamp pop and dance halls in Louisiana to the process of playwriting, and much, much more. The full slate of panels and presentations can be found here. Books Along the Tesh Literary Festival.com. There is also a book fair and writing contest for both adults and children. The festival ends with Symphony Sunday in the Park on April 12th, a free event held at City Park and sponsored by the Iberia Cultural Resources Association. 3 cultural events during the festival that are ticketed, and those involve food, drink, and music, an opening reception, a traditional Southern breakfast, and a Saturday evening concert. The New Orleans Poetry Festival and Small Press is coming up April 16th through 19th, headquartered at the New Orleans Healing Center on St. Claude Avenue. The goal is to create a space for an inclusive and diverse group of writers to collaborate, share, and influence each other while being immersed in the distinctive literary culture of New Orleans. The festival is highly participatory, with events ranging from workshops, where you'll be generating writing, to open mics, where you can share your work. From formal readings and panels to the most informal and collegial interactions and collaborations. For both locals and visitors, we invite the active inspiration of 4 days of poetry immersion and collaboration, hopefully fostering further explorations and creations that continue beyond the time spent here in New Orleans. The book fair takes place at the New Orleans Healing Center, 2372 St. Claude Avenue, all weekend long, Friday through Sunday, April 17th through 19th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's free, open to the public, and the place to score fresh books straight from presses. New this year, the Small Press Fair Happy Hour, Friday from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. in the Grand Hall. Check out nolapoetry.com for the complete schedule.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.